watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. For the past 2 weeks, the program has featured the testimonies of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans from the Winter Soldier Tribunal held earlier this month. We'll continue this week with selected testimony as well as placing it in its context of 9/11 and the project of global domination. Dehumanization of the enemy was one of the topics of the Winter Soldier testimony. Dehumanization of the enemy is part of the goal of military training, not accidental or isolated. Military training is designed to remove the recruit's lifelong moral prohibition against homicide. One witness testified to the importance commanders placed on the first kill and how an officer had offered 4 days of leave to any soldier who made their first kill up close and personal with a blade. I asked myself, what would it take to stab another person to death? To be so close that their blood will spray on you, so that you will see and feel their pain and death. Maybe being filled with rage and hatred, or maybe such fear that adrenaline makes all things possible. Or it takes being like a butcher, seeing the other, not as a sentient being with much the same needs, desires, and feelings as yours, but as a thing whose life has no purpose you are obliged to respect, whose death serves a function. It is those who kill like butchers, without emotion, without guilt, without empathy, that we fear most. In civilian life, we call them psychopaths, sociopaths, monsters. The crimes of the psychopath and the sociopath create intense fear in society because we understand that the killer has dehumanized the victim. We feel powerless to prevent our own victimization by such a person, because an attack could come from anywhere, at any time, with no rhyme or reason that we can comprehend. We fear that we would die offhandedly, like a fly casually swatted. You will hear testimony from veterans that people in Iraq and Afghanistan are being killed just like that. For what? Many of the veterans testify to their belief that in return for putting themselves in harm's way in defense of their country would respect and care for them. Last week, we heard the testimony of Zolly Goodman, whose wife had a miscarriage while he was out to sea doing his naval service. His wife was told by the military hospital that they would not send an ambulance unless she paid $1,500, which she didn't have. Another witness told how women service members who have been raped by their male colleagues on military bases were told they would have to pay for the forensic medical supplies needed to collect evidence of the rape. These veterans have confronted the fact that they have been used up and discarded. But many veterans and civilians are unable to confront the fact that those they were taught to trust and respect have spoon-fed them lies. Many people from the Vietnam War era have still not been able to see it for what it was. It is, I guess, too painful to face that betrayal, too shameful to admit that one has been taken in, too horrifying to realize that one has sacrificed for nothing. There seems to be a similar situation with respect to facing the truth about the 9/11 terrorist attacks. the spider at the heart of this web of betrayal. This week, I'm pleased to be able to bring you a remarkable interview that draws these strands together. A conversation between 9/11 activist scholar-turned-broadcaster Kevin Barrett and international law expert Professor Richard Falk, who first coined the term the Global Domination Project. First, let us begin with the testimony of Iraq veteran Michael Todd at the Winter Soldier Tribunal.
Good morning. My name is Mike Todd, and I served with the 716th MP Battalion in the 101st Airborne. I was deployed to Iraq in April of 2003 and returned home in April of 2004. For the first 6 months of my deployment, I served as a driver for a security vehicle for my command sergeant major and my lieutenant colonel. And for the last 6 months I was put back in a line platoon with the 194th MP Company. I have some slides. This is a picture of me. This is me in Babylon. These are some ancient ruins, thousands of years old. This slide highlights the lack of respect that we had for the ancient culture and for the culture in Iraq to the people of Iraq. Can you go to the next slide, please? This is me in Baghdad, in one of Saddam's palaces in Baghdad, also in the airport, pointing to my American flag, thinking to myself, good job, and being very proud of my country at this point. This slide highlights the arrogance that I had at this point in my life. It displays the heightened sense of importance that I felt and that many of my unit felt. And it also permits us to do harm to the Iraqi people and treat them as second-class citizens. I have a few talking points here. I'm going to highlight that sense of importance and also the general attitude towards the Iraqi people and my unit, and then I'm going to go into some specifics. Like I said, I worked with my command sergeant major often, and he would provide mission briefs and after-action reviews for every mission that we were on. During many of these mission briefs, the language that was used, such as Haji, which is in Arabic a term of endearment, the military has turned that into a disempowering tool, a disempowering word, and it is equatable to some very racist and derogatory remarks from minority populations in this country. Sergeant Major, in one specific mission brief, said to the 9-person team, that Haji is an obstacle, do not let him get in our way. Meaning that if they drive in front of us, get them out of our way. Drive through them. This language that was used was common practice. I often hear it from still being used in many members in my old unit. It was used as a tool to degrade and dehumanize these people. It also permitted ourselves to separate ourselves. It gave us permission to separate ourselves from the people of Iraq, which served as a psychological protective factor should we be doing harm to those people. At one point in the deployment, when I was on a convoy just north of Baghdad, we pulled over to have an MRE refuel our trucks, and it was about a 6-vehicle convoy. Oftentimes, the kids in the surrounding community would run up to us and say thank you, and be very welcome us with warm arms. And we didn't want that kind of attention from the kids for fear of their safety, because we knew we were a targeted audience in that country. And this one incident, a kid was trying to cross a 4-lane median highway and was struck by a vehicle going about 65. A number of us ran over there. I hopped in my truck and ran to stop traffic. A number of us, including my sergeant major, ran over there. And by the time he was walking back to his truck, which was about 30 seconds after he looked at the kid, said, "He's gone. Move out." And I wondered to myself, what would have happened if this was an American kid who was just struck? Pre-deployment, the cultural competency training that we received can be best summed up in a sentence. Don't touch the people of Iraq's left hand. They wipe their ass with it. And that's what we got. This next incident I'm about to describe was the day after we were engaged in an ambush where I was arm's length away from a man who was shot in the neck and died, fell to the street and died. I had to lift him into my truck with my gunner pulled down from the turret, and we brought him into our truck and tried to medevac him. As a grenade blew up my left front tire and flattened it, I took about 15 minutes to get back to the hospital. At that point, he'd bled to death. The incident I'm about to describe is the night after that event. Our mission was in part to run a jail in Karbala, not for enemy prisoners of war, but just for the general population prison. These prisoners would be brought by the Iraqi police, and then we were to show them through the processing and how we do things in America. We weren't in charge necessarily of enemy prisoners of war, but on the night of October 17th in 2003, six people were brought in by the Iraqi police who claimed that these six were participants in the actions the night prior. Therefore, they were enemy prisoners of war due to coalition standards. When these people were brought in, they were appeared to be beaten already badly. They were lined up on the concrete wall, and we told them to interlace their fingers, which is a form of control, because you can grab your middle finger and your index finger and squeeze them together, and it's quite painful. Interlace their fingers, place their foreheads on the concrete wall, cross your ankles, and put your hands on top of your head so we can search you and process you in. They were tagged, they were searched, and they were also beaten. Not just by Americans, but by Bulgarian soldiers and by Polish soldiers, by Iraqi policemen, and by me. I grabbed the man by the jaw and I looked him in the eye, and I slammed his head up against the wall. And I looked him again in the eye and said, "You must have been the one that killed Grilly." And then he fell. I kicked him. An Iraqi policeman, probably the size of the biggest security man here, with hands to match the size of a Kodiak, hit a guy in the side of the head about six times. And I thought to myself, I'm looking at him, and I laughed. I'm like, "Yeah, these guys are getting what they deserve." This all took place also in the presence of a lieutenant. My lieutenant, within earshot of many NCOs. I never found out what happened to these people, these six prisoners. I don't know where they went. I don't know anything about that. And I'm up here today to speak on behalf of all the people who haven't returned home, who can't speak. This isn't just some isolated incident. This happened in the presence of NCOs, commissioned officers, and coalition forces, not only as participants, but also as witnesses. From the night before October 16th, my lieutenant colonel was also killed that night. My being up here displays my anger, both on multiple levels, by the Americans' behavior overseas, by our president's continuous rhetoric about Iraq being a success, about this country's citizens and apathy to this occupation, and this is why I'm here today as well. These events happen in our name, and each and every single one of you are responsible for this as well. I am very sorry for my actions, and I can't take back what I did. I ask the forgiveness of the people of Iraq and of my country, and I will not enable this any further. General Petraeus, you may not remember me, but you once led me. You're no longer a leader of men. You've exploited your troops for your own gain and have become just another cheerleader for this occupation policy that is destroying America.
That is the voice of Michael Todd. He served in Iraq from 2003 and 2004.
General Petraeus, you pinned this on me in Babylon in 2003 following the October 16th incident. I will no longer be a puppet for your personal gain and for your political career.
Tearing up his ribbons. His army commendation.
Iraq veteran Michael Todd. Dr. Kevin Barrett received his PhD in African languages and literature and has taught English, French, Arabic, American civilization, humanities, African literature, folklore, and Islam at colleges and universities in the San Francisco Bay Area, Paris, and Madison, Wisconsin. Barrett became skeptical of the official 9/11 story while on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In 2006, he came under attack by Fox News and Friends for making public his views that 9/11 was an inside job. Though he was exonerated from academic misconduct by the university administration after he addressed the issue in his classes, he was later denied a tenure-track job. He's the co-founder of the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, MUJCA, and now hosts several weekly and biweekly radio shows covering topics related to 9/11 Truth. The interview you're about to hear is from his March 24th Dynamic Duo program that he co-hosts with 9/11 Truth scholar James Fetzer. His guest, Richard Falk, is Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University and a recognized expert on international law. Falk was recently appointed as a special investigator on Israeli actions in the Palestinian territories by the United Nations Human Rights Council, and he has a long resume of prestigious establishment credentials, including a stint on the Council of Foreign Relations. He also serves on the editorial board of The Nation magazine and is the author and contributor to dozens of books, recent among them, The Costs of War, International Law, the UN, and World Order After Iraq. He is credited with introducing Professor David Ray Griffin to the issue of 9/11 Truth. Falk wrote the introduction of Griffin's 2004 book, The New Pearl Harbor, his first on the subject. Kevin Barrett begins by asking Falk about his role as a catalyst for David Ray Griffin's research. The interview was originally broadcast on a commercial network, so please excuse some choppy cuts needed to remove commercial breaks.
You know, back when you wrote that introduction to David Ray Griffin's The New Pearl Harbor, you include a sentence that says, as suggested, this 30% receptivity to Griffin's argument should be enough, which means that all but the most dogmatically blinded adherents of the Bush presidency should be convinced by the basic argument of this book, that is The New Pearl Harbor. And you're not the only one that thought this. Kevin Phillips wrote an editorial for the Los Angeles Times in early 2004 at the same time, saying that he thought that the new Pearl Harbor would probably throw the presidential election away from Bush. It would chase the Bush gang out of the White House. And I thought that too, you know, and I've been speaking out about 9/11 ever since. But it does seem that there are some who are not dogmatic adherents to the Bush presidency who still aren't ready to read the new Pearl Harbor with even a 30% open mind. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a complicated question, actually. I think it is so disturbing to our sense of well-being to distrust our government in such a fundamental way as would be implied by doubting the official version of the 9/11 events. And so there's a lot of what psychologists call denial at work here and avoidance of unpleasant truths. We do it all the time, and this happens to be such a basic reality for our historical moment, that the forces of denial are extremely strong, and those that would defend the official version will be quite ferocious, one would expect, in trying to avoid the truth from being exposed. And that's why David Ray Griffin is very courageous for having taken this on with eyes wide open. He knows what he is doing. He's not a person that's been particularly political in his life, and he's acting out of pure conscience and with the integrity of a lifelong scholar.
I agree completely. In fact, it's his work that got me involved in this after not having been much of an activist either. How did you get interested in David Ray Griffin's work? Or rather, should I say, how did you interest David Ray Griffin in 9/11? Because there is a sort of a story floating around out there that you had you had some of the responsibility for interesting David Ray Griffin in this issue. And if so, you've probably changed history.
Well, I'd like to think so, but it's hard to know how these things happen. We've known each other for a long time, actually in quite a different set of context. I initially met David when he was preoccupied with the sort of philosophical sides and spiritual sides of environmental protection, which was something I'd been interested in a couple decades ago. And he wasn't at that time very interested at all in the politics of the country, but our friendship, I think, did touch on these issues, and he does sort of credit me with having made him interested in the sort of global dimensions of democracy and how to create a sustainable future for humanity, big issues like that. And I think from that came his sense of growing suspicion about what it was our government was doing, not only after 9/11, but in other settings as well.
That's right. He credits you with drawing his attention to the so-called Global Domination Project. And many foreign policy people, especially the so-called neoconservatives and the people dominating the Bush administration, are seeking complete and absolute dictatorial global domination through military force. And, I guess you've been critiquing this idea for quite some time. What is the Global Domination Project?
Well, that was a phrase, I guess, that I did use initially to describe not only the Bush neoconservatives, but also really the Clinton presidency and the whole period after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when it became evident that it was possible, if one thought about the future in terms of strict power and influence, that the United States had the possibility of dominating the world. In the Clinton era, that vision of global dominance and domination was primarily thought to be carried out through market forces, through the American control, really, over how financial and corporate expansion and global reach were being implemented. What changed with the Bush presidency was to militarize this global domination project and to couple it with this kind of very aggressive regime-changing diplomacy that was given a certain plausibility by the way in which the 9/11 attacks were interpreted and the way in which the climate here in this country supported a very aggressive foreign policy.
So, Richard, in your book, The Great Terror War, you write that after 9/11, TV commentators were desperately searching in the immediate aftermath for explanatory tools. They naturally turned to history and the still vivid collective memory of Pearl Harbor to assess the similarities and differences. And I wonder whether you've considered to what extent this turn towards the Pearl Harbor metaphor, which was very, very common post 9/11, may have been to a certain degree planned in advance. The reason I say that is that, well, we have Brzezinski in the Grand Chessboard pointing out that the only way the U.S. could ever mobilize militarily big time is after a Pearl Harbor type event. We have, of course, the Project for a New American Century, neoconservatives calling for a new Pearl Harbor exactly 1 year before it happened. And we also have all sorts of other interesting coincidences, such as $200 million flop blockbuster movie about Pearl Harbor. I wonder who paid for that. It obviously had no audience coming out right before 9/11. We had Donald Rumsfeld running around giving away hundreds and hundreds of copies of Roberta Wohlstetter's book, Pearl Harbor, Warning and Decision, to everybody he ran into in 2000 and 2001. And I could go on about the indications that a lot of powerful people had Pearl Harbor on the brain before 9/11 even happened. So have you considered that? It wasn't just sort of a natural movement to use this metaphor, but, you know, CIA, Operation Mockingbird, people in the journalistic world, and all these other people I've named may have had the whole thing pretty well scripted.
Well, it's really interesting, those elements that you described, some of which I hadn't been familiar with before, including Rumsfeld's interest in the bringing the metaphor to bear on present conditions. And it
right.
does, it certainly, there certainly is a circumstantial case. As far as I know, though, at this point, no one's been able to connect the dots with hard evidence that there was a deliberate link there. All you have is the aura of suspicion that surrounds the 9/11 official version and the unanswered questions that David Griffin has done so much to call our attention to. But it is possibly true that especially the neoconservatives thought that there was a situation in the country and in the world where something had to happen to wake up the American people. Now, whether they are innocent about the contention that they made that something happen or not, I don't think we can answer definitively or at this point. All we can say is there's a lot of grounds for suspicion. There should be a official investigation of the sort that the 9/11 Commission did not engage in, and that the failure to do these things is cheating the American people, and in some sense the people of the world, of a greater confidence in what really happened than they presently possess.
Well, I agree with that. You wrote in one of your articles, I believe it's called Responsible Scholarship in Dark Times, Academics as Scholars, Teachers, and Public Intellectuals, that what has been most disturbing is the anti-conspiracy fury of the moderate left, with among the strongest discrediting attacks being mounted in such places as The Nation or Counterpunch. And I find this puzzling as somebody who read Griffin, saw it was a very strong argument and started raising this issue both in activism and in academia, that other academics and moderate left people just can't seem to handle this. And I guess you're on the board at The Nation magazine. Why has The Nation been so slow in coming to grips with this material? And, you know, why are they publishing apparent disinformation by the likes of David Korn, who's, you know, has quite a reputation as the fawning biographer of Ted Shackley, CIA station chief in Miami, suspect in the JFK assassination, and also a suspected drug runner. So David Korn, who just fawned all over Shackley in his biography, is the guy that The Nation hires to do a hatchet job on the 9/11 truth movement. What's happening at The Nation magazine?
Well, I don't know the details of what has happened at The Nation, but I think it's part of a broader set of conditions that affects what I've been calling the moderate left, which is that they are so concerned about their own credibility that they feel that to in any way endorse a conspiracy view of what actually happened, or even to have an open mind about it, will marginalize them further in society. So I think it's a kind of defense mechanism that people who feel already somewhat on the margins of American political life and American political culture, that they are doing this by way of showing that they should be taken seriously and that their views should be taken seriously. It's unfortunate, as I've tried to indicate, but if one wants to understand why it's happening, I think that's the best explanation.
I think you're probably right. It seems ironic, though, that in going this route to be taken seriously, they're alienating a large number of people who've actually looked at the facts on this and other matters. A similar trajectory happened at the Nation after the JFK assassination. And people who bother to acquaint themselves with the facts about these kind of events often end up being so suspicious of the Nation and other organs like the New York Times that, in a sense, it seems to me they're discrediting themselves a lot more by refusing to at least have an open mind than they would be by just, you know, taking a sort of a moderate approach and allowing both sides to have an honest debate.
Yes, I completely agree with you, Kevin. I think that it is a real case of missing a big, big boat by the failure of the Nation and Counterpunch and some other left-to-center organs, that they are unwilling to expose what is known about these seminal happenings that are so important to understanding the politics of this country.
Okay, hear, hear. We'll be back in a moment.
Dr. Kevin Barrett's interview with international law professor Richard Falk continues.
Richard, you've had some interesting observations on the current presidential elections in an article entitled What to Expect from the Next American President in the Middle East. You point out that Obama has an edge over Hillary and certainly over McCain on his clarity on Iraq. He is less enamored of military solutions than the other candidates. He seems to be clear about not wanting to shoot for regime change, which never really seems to work. And you also have pointed out that Obama alone among the candidates has expressed a dedication to working for a world free of nuclear weapons, which, of course, is perhaps humanity's greatest challenge, or at least right up there with the energy and environmental challenges. Most of my listeners are pretty skeptical about the mainstream candidates. Maybe you can help reassure them that Obama is for real in these areas.
Well, I hope he's for real, Kevin. It's hard to say. There have been many disappointments in the past. When one compares what presidential candidates say when they're seeking support and what they do when they're president. And my analysis was based on a comparison with Clinton and McCain, not a suggestion that Obama will pursue the kind of foreign policy that I would like to see this country following. And I'm not sure that he will go very far in the directions that you mention as coming from my positive view of his foreign policy perspective. I do think the one really encouraging aspect of a comparison is that his advisors were people who were, by and large, opposed to the Iraq war, whereas Hillary Clinton's advisors are by and large so-called liberal hawks who were, at the outset at least, promoting the Iraq war. That doesn't mean that on issues like Israel-Palestine one can expect anything very different from Obama than one would get from Clinton or McCain, for that matter. And in some ways, that's the most urgent issue in the region, aside from ending the Iraq War itself.
I agree with that. And you've spoken eloquently about that in your article, Slouching Toward a Palestinian Holocaust. You wrote, quote, "It is especially painful for me, as an American Jew, to feel compelled to portray the ongoing and intensifying abuse of the Palestinian people by Israel through a reliance on such an inflammatory metaphor as Holocaust. Is it an irresponsible overstatement to associate the treatment of Palestinians with this criminalized Nazi record of collective atrocity?" And you go on to say that it really isn't. That's a very, very strong statement. Have you taken any flack for that? Because people who speak that strongly often do.
Yeah, well, it certainly has attracted feedback, both positive and negative. And it was written before even worse policies have been pursued. And I think we are witnessing a situation of massive collective punishment of a people entrapped within borders. When the wall separating Gaza and Egypt was breached, 500,000 people rushed out of the opening that was created for a few days to breathe the fresh air of a country other than where they were basically imprisoned. And I think since my little piece appeared, the deputy minister of defense in Israel used the phrase Shoah, which is the Hebrew word for Holocaust, to warn the Palestinians that if they didn't stop resisting Israel's control, they would face a Shoah, in effect, face a Holocaust. This was later explained as saying that meant just disaster, but in the Israeli context, to use that word is certainly comparable to my using the word Holocaust.
And that was quite an unbelievable quote to be coming from an Israeli government official. And taking it back to the presidential election, as you've said, none of the three major candidates seem to promise any serious departures from business as usual, which means, I guess, a continuing Palestinian Holocaust. How can Americans work to try to change direction on this issue?
Well, I see no shortcut to raising consciousness, education, creating a more realistic awareness of the kind of victimization that the Palestinian people are currently experiencing, and the existence of a real alternative, which is for the two people to live in peace together once Israel accepts the burden of adhering to international law on the issues that divide the two peoples at the present time. On nearly all of these issues, international law is on the side of the Palestinians, whether it be withdrawal from the occupied territories that have been held since 1967, or whether it's the sharing of Jerusalem, or whether it's the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes within pre-67 Israel, and whether it is the dismantling of the settlements and the security wall. All of these issues are clearly addressed by international law, and it is pretty much totally on the side of the Palestinians.
And, of course, the one issue that so many so-called mainstream thinkers claim is impossible to resolve is that right of return, which, as you say, is guaranteed by international law. But the counterargument is that Israel has the preponderance of force, and they will never accept that. Is there any way out of that quandary?
Yes, I think if there was goodwill on the part of the Israelis to allow the Palestinians to have a genuine sovereign state that was equal to their own, there would be a lot of willingness on the Palestinian side to reach some sort of accommodation on the refugee issue, which would allow Israel to remain as a Jewish state and would give the Palestinians certainly some symbolic and some substantive realization of their rights with respect to refugees, but would at the same time acknowledge that there is a de facto situation that has to be accommodated if peace is to be achieved for the two peoples.
Well, yeah, I agree with that outlook. I agree completely that I think if Israel withdrew to the 67 borders, the Palestinians would be willing to compromise on the implementation of right of return, especially if the Israelis were willing to respect it, at least in theory. So we do have a caller. It's Harvey from Florida. Come in, Harvey. How are you?
Good, Kevin. How are you?
Pretty good.
I'd like to ask you and your guest, Richard, I think something very pertinent to what you're speaking about. No, I think only a few things can happen that America can come out of this mess that we're in. And one would be for somebody, maybe this Admiral Fallon that just resigned, maybe he would have the courage to come forward like Smedley Butler did many years ago and talk about what's really going on and what's really behind all of this. What do you think about that?
Well, Harvey, I think that's an interesting observation, and I agree with the general point that something has to break through our sense of normalcy, or we can't reconnect with this underlying reality that is driving us toward a terrible future catastrophe. And maybe a figure like Admiral Fallon would have the audacity and the clarity of mind to play such a role. As far as I know, there's no indication that that's on his mind. He seems to be pursuing a kind of narrowly circumscribed professionalism, which led him to resign because he didn't favor the kind of policies that were coming from the White House.
Well, you're familiar with what Smedley Butler did in the 30s, I believe, right?
Remind me. I am generally familiar, but I don't remember the specific details.
Okay. He described the plot in which they tried to get him to take part in exactly what we're seeing today, the overthrow of the America as we know it. And Smedley Butler, at great risk to himself, exposed the whole thing. And he also had a book. Book that he came out with was
War is a Racket.
War is a Racket. It's the same thing we're going through today, so I think that's our greatest hope. But there is, the American people are so unreceptive because General Sanchez recently came out with a statement that he wasn't allowed to really do anything to win the war in Iraq, and he was barely listened to. Actually, the media didn't cover him too much at all. And the other possible good outcome for the American people that I can see, do you remember the movie Treasure of Sierra Madre?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, we don't need those stinking badges.
Great movie.
Yeah.
We don't need no stinking badges. But you know how they were fighting over the loot. So
yes.
Maybe that's the best we could hope for, an internal struggle where they're all fighting over the treasure of Iraq.
Well, that's kind of a good metaphor for the global struggle over energy resources, too, where if we waste the last energy that we have fighting over the last few drops, we're all going to end up like those three guys in the movie.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Maybe that's a good outcome for the world if that happened. They all start killing each other for the treasure that they're seeking.
Well, thanks, Harvey. I appreciate the the observations. I think you're right on the money there. You know, Richard.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I really enjoy your programs.
Great. Well, thanks. And feel free to call in anytime. Take care. Richard, Harvey makes a very good point, I think, about the need for military whistleblowers and truth tellers. Colonel Bob Bowman has called for U.S. officers to arrest Bush and Cheney if they order an illegal strike on Iran. But unfortunately, it does seem that Admiral Fallon's path doesn't give any indication that he or anybody else is planning to do such a thing. I know that you've written that You think that, actually here I have the direct quote, because it seems unlikely that an attack on Iran will occur because of its anticipated costs, skyrocketing oil prices, retaliatory missile strikes, blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, a further overstretching of the already overstretched American military, the likely hostile reaction of world public opinion, and considerable opposition within the United States. Are you still that sanguine that the Cheney regime isn't going to go after Iran before they leave power, if they do decide to leave power?
Well, I am not quite as convinced as I was when I wrote those words, though I think the objective situation hasn't changed. I think it is widely recognized that such an attack would have disastrous consequences, and that it is has served no genuine security purpose. But that doesn't mean it won't happen, and there are some disquieting elements, including what prompted Admiral Fallon to resign and some indications that the deployment in the Persian Gulf has been augmented, the naval deployment has been augmented. There are some suggestions that the Bush presidency would like to arrange an October surprise in order to assist the Republican candidate to retain the White House for the conservative cause. So all of these things make one wary of being too hopeful that a policy as crazy as attacking Iran will not happen. I still think and hope that it won't, but I'm not at all sure.
Well, I do too. There are plenty of voices who are saying that it doesn't look that unlikely to them. Paul Craig Roberts, the former chief economic advisor to Ronald Reagan, just published an article today called "Is There a Dirty Bomb in America's Future?" in which he cites the recent novel by Steve Alton, The Shell Game, which is about a plan to blow up a couple of American cities with nuclear weapons, blame it on the Iranians, and go all out into Iran. That's such an October surprise would be more like an October Armageddon, but it would have the desirable consequences for the Cheney regime of keeping them in power indefinitely, allowing them to cancel elections, and perhaps to avoid future war crimes prosecution. It seems to me that's part of this dilemma that we're in with their obvious, to me at least, obvious complicity in 9/11 and many, many other war crimes. They have a very strong incentive not to leave power voluntarily.
Yes, I think that is correct. Of course, it would have a disastrous effect on the economy, which is already in terrible shape, and I would expect a lot of very conservative voices would oppose anything that would drive the economic prospects of the society into a state of utter collapse. I mean, so it's hard for me to envision any rational process that could lead to this kind of outcome. But as I said, history is filled with examples of rampant irrationality and desperate maneuvers. So it's important not to rule it out.
That's right. The greater good seems to be a concept that has been left by the wayside with some of these people. And I think Juan Bosch, who was the president, I believe, of the Dominican Republic, who was thrown out of office by Johnson's coup d'etat in, was it, 65 or so?
Yeah, 65.
Right. He wrote a book on imperialism, saying that the people who were really being colonized were the people of the home country by a small minority of profiteers in the military business. And it sure seems to me that that's what we've got here. So they might very well damage the overall economy of the country and profit themselves, which, of course, is what they've been doing for the past 7 years. I'm Kevin Barrett. The guest is Richard Foss, Professor Emeritus at Princeton, And one of our leading scholars of international relations and world order, from a human rights perspective, we were just talking about the danger of war with Iran and or some kind of October surprise to give the Republicans, or shall we say the Cheney faction, an edge. I guess that sort of ties in with the whole question of how much meaning there really is in the presidential elections. You know, the last election we had was a clear mandate against the Iraq war, and yet nothing much happened. The Democrats came into power and made no move whatsoever to end the war, which was, of course, their mandate. So, Richard, you, as I pointed out in the first segment, you wrote an article showing that Obama seems to have a little bit more promise than the other candidates in this international relations area. The question is, will his advisors like Brzezinski genuinely be moving towards this kind of vision of demilitarizing the world, since he doesn't really have that kind of reputation? And I've heard, what on one side of that debate, Webster Tarpley has argued that Brzezinski is still an unreconstructed warmonger who's out for all-out war with the Russians. And on the other side of the debate, Peter Dale Scott, who I had on the show recently, argues that Brzezinski has seen the error of his ways and is now something of a peacenik. What's your take on what's happening with Brzezinski?
I think it's hard to say. I think the fact that he has identified with Obama is a mildly encouraging sign, but I wouldn't push it too hard. I do think Brzezinski is an intelligent realist, and that he is more likely than many others to see that overreaching militarily will be self-destructive at this period of American history. At the same time, he's very mainstream and eager to convey his realist sensibilities. So I wouldn't expect an Obama presidency to engage in any significant form of disarmament or demilitarization. In fact, Obama himself has called for an increase in the level of in the number of personnel in the armed forces, and for an even greater overseas deployment of American military power. So on a structural level, I don't think we can have any real hope that there will be a change in policy. One of the glaring needs for this country is to stop wasting hundreds of billions of dollars on a military machine that at best is wasted and at worst, as in Iraq, is used. And this idea that we need 700 military bases overseas and navies in every ocean is slowly, maybe not so slowly, bankrupting the country, destroying its infrastructure, and creating a militarist culture that has very little hope of escaping from the dilemmas that it finds itself trapped in at the present time.
Well, that certainly seems clear to me, and clear to people spanning the political spectrum from Gore Vidal on the left to Ron Paul on the right. But interestingly, it seems that the mainstream media and mainstream discourse, even in the academy, prohibits these kinds of eminently sensible perspectives, whether they're on the left or the right. Look at how Ron Paul couldn't buy 5 seconds of honest media coverage, despite his campaign coming on like gangbusters. Why is the media and the academy and the other institutions of our society, how can they be that locked out as far as bringing in a simple, sensible perspective that we need to change our priorities in terms of military spending?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. The media and the universities, to a large extent, are corporatized, and they create a set of taboos about what is permissible issues for national debate. And the three things you can't really do if you want to be credible nationally is you can't criticize the Pentagon or the military budget or the military in general. You can't criticize Wall Street in any serious way. And you can't criticize Israel as a strategic ally of the U.S. And with those three constraints on what is permissible to discuss, there's very little political space left for leaders to enact creatively and constructively an alternative foreign policy for the country. And that's why I am rather pessimistic about what we can expect from the next president internationally.
It would seem that with Obama, the apparent peacenik among the three mainstream candidates calling for more military personnel and more overseas deployment, it would seem that the new Pearl Harbor, if that's indeed what 9/11 really was, which has essentially doubled our military budget almost overnight, has succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of the authors of Project for New American Centuries, Rebuilding America's Defenses. They actually called for a somewhat slower military spending buildup than we've actually had. And now we have Obama on board with that. It would suggest to me that if indeed 9/11 was the commercial for aggressive militarism that it appears to have been, it's succeeded at that level.
Yes, I completely agree. And even if you grant for the moment that 9/11 was authentic and was essentially what it appears to be, it still has driven this country in a spiral of escalating and essentially self-destructive military expenditures and military adventures. And in that sense, the failure of the American people to repudiate the Bush presidency in 2004 and the failure of Congress and the Democratic Party to really offer some significant principled opposition to these policies goes way beyond whatever 9/11 was. It suggests a real condition of national political decadence, in my view.
Well, I agree completely. We did, however, have a sort of a gradual drawdown of the military budget during the 1990s. And post 9/11, as we've seen, even the peacenik candidate this year is looking to increase this military buildup that has gone into overdrive post 9/11 beyond the wildest dreams of the neocons. And I would suggest that maybe the American people, or at least a significant segment of the American people, are not going to be able to even talk about getting back to a more sensible kind of military spending picture unless we can talk about 9/11 truth and explode the myth of 9/11. Perhaps, you know, even if people hadn't done their homework and didn't think it was an inside job, they should still be saying that it was, because that's the only way we're going to get back to some sane policy. So this is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Richard Falk, the eminent international relations scholar and an international law professor. Richard, one of your articles that looks to have been prescient is Vietnam Syndrome, which you published, I believe, shortly before 9/11. And in that article, you actually are quoting John McCain, who argues that Vietnam was the kind of war that required its participants to hate the enemy. And you point out that McCain unabashedly makes a combat virtue out of hate. You quote him as saying, "I hated my enemies even before they held me captive, because hate sustained me in my devotion to their complete destruction and helped me overcome the virtuous human impulse to recoil in disgust from what had to be done by my hand." You point out that this kind of exaltation of hatred, especially when it informs a ground war carried on in the midst of a densely inhabited civilian society, is disastrous Thus, it shouldn't surprise us that My Lai and similar incidents were commonplace in Vietnam. And you published this in 2001. It seems to have very correctly predicted what has happened over in Iraq.